From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Dorothy Kilgallen was an American journalist and television game show panelist. And after spending two semesters at the College of New Rochelle, she started her career shortly before her 18th birthday as a reporter for the Hearst Corporation's New York Evening Journal. In 1938, she began her newspaper column, The Voice of Broadway, which eventually was syndicated to more than 140 papers, and in those days, that was huge. In 1950, she became a regular panelist on the television game show What's My Line, continuing in that role until her death.
Now let's meet our award-winning What's My Line panel. First, the popular columnist whose Voice of Broadway appears in papers from coast to coast, Miss Dorothy Kilgallen.
Gentlemen, and tonight it's a great pleasure to introduce to you our guest panelist, someone who spells wonderful entertainment for all members of the family, the gentleman who stars in The Life of Riley, Mr. Bill Bendix.
Kilgallen's columns featured mostly show business news and gossip, but ventured into other topics such as politics and organized crime. She wrote front-page articles on the Sam Shepard trial, which ended up being the television show The Fugitive, and later the John F. Kennedy assassination. And then she strangely died. In a moment, one of our favorite guests joins us, Mark Shaw, author of Denial of Justice, the reporter who knew too much, and a new book called Collateral Damage. He is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me introduce our guest, Mark Shaw, former criminal defense attorney, legal analyst for CNN, ESPN, USA Today. He did covered stories like the Mike Tyson, O.J. Simpson, Kobe Bryant cases as well. Mark Shaw is an investigative reporter, author of many books. I just mentioned a few of them. He is a member of the American Society for Journalists and Authors and has written for USA Today, The Huffington Post, and the Aspen Daily News. He's a regular guest here on Coast to Coast and generally was with me in March of this year as well. Mark, welcome back. I wanted to get some updates, but I'm glad you're with us, my friend. How are you?
Hey, thank you, George. And I want to say again so much I appreciate your having me on the show. Since I was on the last time, I've probably heard from at least 25 of your listeners who have sent along support or tips or whatever. And you played the What's My Line show with William Bendix and Dorothy there. One of your listeners, I wish I had gotten her name, but I can't quite recall it. She compiled, and you can imagine how long this must have taken, George, but she went through all of the What's My Line shows she could and compiled the 10 or 15 most amazing shows with Dorothy Kilgallen on them. And if people go to YouTube, they can find those, and they're just priceless. So, again, I appreciate your having me on the show because I always hear from listeners, but this one went an extra mile to put all of that up on YouTube.
Great. I remember watching What's My Line as a kid, black and white television, and she would come out, Arlene Francis, Bennett Cerf, then they'd always have a guest person join them, and then they had to guess what the occupation was of everybody. And then every once in a while, they brought in a celebrity, and they had to put blindfolds on to guess who that person was. It was a great show.
Well, it was, and it was more of an intelligent type of quiz show than we have today. You know, it's like film or television, George, or your show. Your show comes together. It's kind of a magic that brings it all together. That's what they had with What's My Line. Now, people have watched the show after Dorothy died, and it wasn't the same because they had the perfect mix of people, just the ones you mentioned there, Arlene Francis and Bennett Cerf and Dorothy especially. It's a magical show, and I'm so pleased that people all over the world have watched those episodes that never knew much about Dorothy before I was able to write the two books about her.
Well, I got to tell you, your work is just fantastic. I was talking with our executive producer, Lisa, this week, and I said, you know what? I want Mark back on. I've been really rereading your book, The Denial of Justice, and I'm getting into things, and I'm picking up things that I missed the first time around. And it is just fantastic. Yeah. Like, I really didn't understand how good she was as a reporter. She started so young. Her dad helped her get the first job. But she was darn good at what she did.
Yeah, she really was. It's an inspiring story in many ways. You said 18 years old is when she started, and she became what the New York Post called the most powerful female voice in America. And just imagine that. And I'm pleased to say, and I'll be able to announce, they're going to announce this in a couple of weeks, but a major university has asked to have all of my papers, my books, my research books, all of my notes and documents and videotapes, and hopefully even some of the podcasts from your show in their archives. And they became so interested because of what Dorothy Kilgallen represents. They're interested in connecting my research with their journalism department and their and their, you know, communications department, because, you know, she was, and I still think she is, and many people have said, we wish we had reporters like Dorothy Kilgallen today. And so I'm very honored that that's going to happen, and more people will be able to learn about Dorothy. But if you think about the time period, George, that was when, you know, it was even tougher for women to, you know, to get through those obstacles, the gender discrimination and all of that. But Dorothy never worried about that. She just started out and started writing. And I will tell you this, if I could write half as well as Dorothy did, I'd have 25 bestsellers, because she was such a wordsmith. Remember, Ernest Hemingway called her the greatest female writer in the world.
Exactly.
You know, and in the new book, Collateral Damage, I found more of her columns. And when I read them and I see her writing, I'm just amazed, because she was so perceptive of the human condition at the time. And I'm trying to humanize her a little bit more in the new book.
Well, she died November 8th, 1965, 52 years old, which the coroner claimed intoxication and barbiturates, a combination. But you have questioned that, and a lot of other people have too, Mark.
Well, and rightfully so. We'll get to the new book and the similarities between Marilyn Monroe's death and Dorothy's. But with Dorothy, you know, we've got too many of these cases, the Epstein case now, some of these police shootings, other cases that come along where we really never get the facts. There's no transparency. For whatever reason, there's either no investigation or not a thorough investigation. And, of course, that's what just happened with Dorothy. She's the most credible reporter to have ever covered the JFK assassination. I've said it many times. I'm so blessed to kind of have had her guide me along with my research on all of the topics having to do with the assassination. But, you know, Dorothy covered the assassination for 18 months. She was at the Jack Ruby trial. She's the only one who interviewed Jack Ruby. She exposed his testimony before the Warren Commission before it was supposed to be released. I wasn't there. A lot of these guys that write about the assassination wasn't there. So, weren't there. So, you know, Dorothy is the expert. And I'm so pleased that, you know, in continuing my research with her, I found even more of the expertise that she had during that time period. And that's why, you know, so many people have decided in their own minds that what she found out and what she was going to put in that book for Random House just before she died, you know, is the most credible information about the JFK assassination, for sure.
Was her body moved in the townhouse she was living in New York when she had died?
No question about it. And that's some of the new research. It's amazing to me how I find this research. It's like I'm kind of a magnet for the George. I'm from a small town in Indiana. I'm not the smartest person in the world. It took me 5.5 years to get through Purdue. You know, and yet it's just amazing. In this will be the fifth book now I've written that's touched on the JFK assassination. I have no idea where this come from. You know, today a guy sent me an email, and he says he interviewed Dorothy's two children 1 year after she died, and gave me all kinds of facts about what happened. And it did include the fact that on the night she died, we know what happened. She went to the What's My Line show. You can see that last show and watch it on YouTube, and you'll see how vivacious she was and how well-dressed she was, as usual.
Impeccable.
She went to P.J. Clark's and had a drink, went to a hotel, met a mystery man, and then went home. Well, I've been able to prove that there were three barbiturates in her system, not one.
Hold on right there, Mark. Hold on for a second. We're at the break. We'll come back and pick this up. It's an incredible story. She was interviewing Jack Ruby while he was in his trial. He since died of cancer while he was in jail. It's an incredible story. Mark Shaw back with us in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Mark Shaw with us. Mark, we were talking about how Dorothy's body was kind of moved around. That's kind of weird, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's amazing to me with some of these crime scenes what happens. We now know, and I think we have proven in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much and then Denial of Justice, that, you know, when the police finally came to Dorothy Kilgallen's townhouse, she'd already been dead for several hours. And you wonder then what happened during that time. We now know that there was the FBI came, kind of swarmed the apartment, took out of all of her documents, investigative files, everything like that. And then the medical examiner, a junior medical examiner, not the main one, came and just took a look at a empty Seconal bottle and decided that she'd overdosed, not checking to see that she had actually died in the bathroom and then was taken into the bedroom. That's been proven. So, you know, you get these situations where, the crime scene is not as it was when she died, and that's what happened with Dorothy. And really what occurred there, I finally interviewed Dr. Michael Bodden, who I think you've had on your program before, about a month or two ago for the new book, and I wanted to ask him why they came up with the solution, the verdict, that it was a combination of an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol, circumstances undetermined. And I asked him why in the world then they went ahead and told the media that she died of an accidental death. And he admitted, he said, it looks to me like, and his name, by the way, was on the autopsy report, basically that they didn't know what happened to Dorothy. And yet they said it was an accidental death. And the main detective on the case, I found a quote from him where he said if he would have known that it wasn't an accidental death, he would have investigated. So unfortunately, you know, with these kinds of cases, everything gets all mixed up, and then you really don't have the truth. You're a man of the truth, George, and we can't really find at times the truth about these kinds of cases.
And what a story it was. And didn't the FBI raid the house, too, and grab some documents?
They did. And you know, these are true crime murder mysteries. All of my books are about Dorothy Kilgallen. The new one is as well, Collateral Damage. But in this situation, you have a true crime murder mystery because I think I told you the last time I was on the show that I had found a reliable source in Las Vegas who told me exactly how Dorothy was set up for the kill. There was a boyfriend of hers, the main suspect, Ron Pataki, who learned about what Dorothy was going to put in the book for Random House. He told the wrong people what happened, this guy told me, this source, and therefore they had to be able to eliminate her because they couldn't write that. She couldn't write that book for Random House. And so, you know, in that situation, you look at motive, and then you know, we now know with an eyewitness that J. Edgar Hoover sent his agents into her office, into her townhouse, to destroy that file of hers, that thick file of hers on the investigation of JFK. So he becomes even more of a suspect than he was before, as well as Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans Don, who had another motive to have eliminated Dorothy.
Is Pataki still alive?
Yes, he is. And this has been an exciting time since I was on the show last. Some successes and some failures. It's amazing. You know, I've been able to show, you know, the fact that we're still trying to hide the truth with the Ruby trial transcripts, for instance, which are the most important documents about the assassination and clearly show a plot to kill the president. The sixth floor museum at Daley Plaza in Dallas still distorts history with only information about the Oswald alone theory. And then my attempts to get Dorothy an investigation, George. It's amazing to me. Vance Jr., the New York District Attorney, as you know, agreed to do a thorough investigation, and then he pulled the plug after 8 months. I went to New York, I think I told you, in February, and met Commissioner Dermot Shea of the New York Police Department. I shook his hand. There's a photograph of him and me on my website, markshawbooks.com. He gave me the name of a detective in his department and the detective's business card and said that I could communicate with that detective. I got back to my home in California. I sent emails to that detective. None were answered. I left a phone message for him. None were answered. And finally, I realized that what Shea had done was in many ways shameless. He had really lied to me in my face. I don't think he ever intended for the detective to get back to me. And so that really has disappointed me. There's a letter I wrote to Shea that's on my website, markshawbooks.com, complaining about what happened. I filed a Freedom of Information request trying to get them to go forward because of all the new evidence I have about Ron Pataky. It's overwhelming, George, that he was complicit in Dorothy's death. And besides using a fellow officer as kind of a shield here, which I believe is really derogatory with any officer who's under the command of the commissioner of the New York Police Department, a killer is going to go free here unless they investigate. And that this case qualifies on every level as a cold case squad investigation, and yet I can't get them to go after this. I assume your audience, and maybe you as well, are thinking, why is everybody scared of Dorothy Kilgallen's case that happened in 1965?
Right. What did she know?
Exactly. And there's something there, and of course, we both know when the government is investigating the government, it's an uphill battle. But this little pint-sized woman scares the hell out of people with regard to what she knew about the assassination. Nobody wants to jump into that case at all, but I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to expose what Shea did, and I'm going to try to get an independent investigation.
What do you think Jack Ruby told her in his prison cell?
Well, this is fascinating because, I just got a chill, George, because again today, I think Ruby, what do we know Dorothy did? She lost her file, so we don't have the notes. In the new book, by the way, I have a picture of her in Daly Plaza. It shows she was right there and right at the trial. Where did she go right after the Ruby trial? She didn't go to Washington, D.C. and look into Johnson, President Johnson, or the CIA or anybody. She didn't, stay in Dallas. She went to New Orleans. And as we both know, I've looked at the assassination differently than anybody ever has. Why Bobby Kennedy was not killed instead of why JFK was. And when you have that perspective, which is the same one that Dorothy had, I believe, you realize that Marcello, who was pursued by Bobby Kennedy right after Kennedy became Attorney General and had deported him and charged him with racketeering.
And then he got back in again.
Killed JFK so Bobby would be powerless. So that's where Dorothy went. And she successfully had one trip there. Remember, that was a very mysterious trip with her hairdresser saying in the videotapes that I have on the DorothyKilgallenStory.org that when they got there, she called him and said, go back to New York. Don't tell anybody you were here. She goes back to New York, and unfortunately she starts saying, if the wrong people knew what I know about the JFK assassination, it could cost me my life. I'm afraid for my life and my family. I've bought a gun, and she was dead shortly thereafter. So what did Ruby say? Well, today, this gentleman who got in touch with me from Florida told me that he interviewed two of the children of Dorothy, Richard Jr. and Carrie, and while they were talking, they said to him that Jack Ruby had told Dorothy that if he could just get in front of an independent jury, he would tell the truth about what happened.
Wow.
And I think when Dorothy learned that, that's what extended her investigation and into New Orleans. That's where we are right now.
Didn't Ruby know Carlos Marcello?
Oh, it's just amazing.
And Santo Traficante, he knew them both. He was running strip clubs for them, wasn't he?
And if this all goes back to my first book about this assassination, about Melvin Belleye, the San Francisco lawyer that I knew and practiced law with in the 80s. And who was Jack Ruby's lawyer, and he was all mobbed up with Mickey Cohen and all of that, brought in to silence Jack Ruby, and of course then Ruby we connect easily with Marcello through his underlings, because Marcello's empire, George, extended to Dallas. And there's these little things that Dorothy picked up, and it's amazing to me that people missed them back then. The very first visitor to Jack Ruby in jail was a guy named Campisi, and Joe Savello, Joe Campisi and Joe Savello, but Campisi was the first one. Well, who was he working for in Dallas? Carlos Marcello.
Yeah, exactly.
And Traficante.
Did the name Jimmy Hoffa come up much, Mark, in your work?
What's that?
Jimmy Hoffa's name, did it come up much?
Yeah, it did. And it comes through an interesting book by Frank Regano, who was a lawyer in Florida. You may have heard his name, but it's called Mob Lawyer. I've suggested people read it because imagine this as your three main clients, James Hoffa, Santo Traficante, and Carlos Marcello. And I interviewed Regano's widow, Nancy, and she was able to tell me about the connections between Hoffa, the gangsters, Ruby, Oswald being... I now have an eyewitness who saw Oswald in Marcello's restaurant in New Orleans. You know, you can easily connect all of those people, and I'll tell you what the common denominator is, common sense. That's what Dorothy was really good at, you know, at the Sam Shepard case or the Lindbergh baby kidnapping case. I mean, she was a better trial lawyer than most trial lawyers.
Right.
She really was.
Well, and in this case, too, with the situation with Hoffa, he hated Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, my
hated
God.
Him with a passion.
Well, I would think you would when the Attorney General of the United States tries to strangle you. I mean, when Hoffa tries to strangle the Attorney General of the United States, yeah, I think that's hatred. And so, you know, they all had a motive. You know, Bobby Kennedy is a big part of the new book, Collateral Damage. I'm going to connect the deaths of Dorothy Kilgallen, Marilyn Monroe, and JFK, and the common denominator there is Bobby Kennedy. You know, it's amazing. You know, you have three deaths there, George, within 40 months.
Yeah.
Marilyn dies in August of 62, JFK November 63, and Dorothy November 65. 40 months, all three of these individuals died, and I've been amazed now at the similarities I've found in each of their lives and their professional and private lives, and then connecting them together with regard to their tragic death.
And then eventually Bobby goes.
And then Bobby is killed in 68, and you know, again, common sense. Look, what happened when Bobby Kennedy, when Jack Kennedy died? Bobby Kennedy was powerless. He broke up that huge group of federal investigators, never went after those mobsters again.
That's right. LBJ basically stymied him, didn't he?
He resigned in September of 1967. Then he's going to run for president. Now, many people asked me to write this book about Marilyn with Dorothy and JFK, but they also want me to write about Bobby Kennedy's death because use a little common sense. Is there any connection between Sirhan Sirhan and the same gangsters? You know, I've never looked into that, but somebody certainly should, because common sense would say what? These gangsters are now free of Bobby Kennedy, and then Kennedy runs for president. What would be the first thing he would do when he entered the White House? He would go back and investigate those guys for their participation in his brother's death.
Yep.
And remember what Bobby said, and this has been, you know, proven by many other people besides me. What did he say when he heard that JFK had been killed? Well, I thought it would be me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, mm-hmm. He was right. He knew it was supposed to be him. That's what the prosecutor of Jack Ruby, Bill Alexander, told me. He expected Bobby Kennedy to be killed.
See, they were concerned if Bobby got killed, JFK would assign some other prosecutors to go after the same people.
Absolutely. It doesn't take too much to think that Bobby Kennedy, they couldn't let him become president of the United States. It just wasn't going to happen. You know, Nick Pileggi, you may have interviewed him, an incredible writer, you know, who wrote Wise Guys and those films. He used to tell me, you know, you can't mess around with those mafioso, the Sicilians. It's all about revenge. And I think I may have told you this story before, a personal story. When I was with Good Morning America and covering trials and things, they sent me to Philadelphia to interview the lawyer for Anthony Russo, or whatever his name was, Angelo Bruno, the main gangster in Philadelphia, and they were trying to get into Atlantic City. So I went to Philadelphia. I sat down with this lawyer, and he started telling me things about, you know, the mafia boss that I didn't think he should be telling me. They played that the next day, the tape of it, on Good Morning America, Sandy Hill and David Hartman, maybe your listeners will remember.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, will he talk to you again? Because it was a big hit. And I said, well, I'll find out. I called his office. This secretary answered. She was kind of whimpering, and I said, are you okay? And she said, well, I guess you don't know Mr. Shaw. He was sitting in his car this morning, and it blew up.
Jeez. That was during that time all those car bombings were happening.
You can't mess around with those guys.
No.
And Joe Kennedy, appointing Bob, telling JFK to appoint Bobby Kennedy, double-crossing them. You know, it all comes around in life, George, and... You know, it's really unfortunate that Jack Kennedy died. He should have never died. That's part of the collateral damage here, as Marilyn is and as Dorothy Kilgallen is in the new book.
Did I ever tell you that I may have been one of the last newsmen to talk to Jimmy Hoffa?
No.
May 1975 in Detroit. I invite him to a TV show I was producing. He came in. He did it. I walked him to his car. We chatted a little bit. We shook hands, and off he went. My theory is twofold, Mark, with Jimmy Hoffa. I think, one, he wanted to regain the Teamster presidency, and the mob was so involved with Frank Fitzsimmons getting better deals than they were getting with Jimmy, they didn't want Jimmy back. But I also think part of me thinks that Jimmy was going to rat on them over the JFK assassination.
Oh, and I've never thought of that.
And so they bump him off. Because they were afraid he was going to talk.
Interesting. Because, well, look, you know, he and Marcello and Trafficante were, you know, three birds together, and Frank Regano connects them completely. So that makes sense. I think I'll try to look into that. Is it all right if I...
Yeah, that could be another book for you.
Use your research here. Yes.
Absolutely. And, you know, mine was firsthand experience. But that I always had that feeling when I was with Hoffa. That it wasn't just the Teamster presidency he was after. There was something else.
Of him, George?
He was a tough, strong unionist. And there were times when companies would abuse the American working man or woman, and they needed a tough president. And in those days, those unions used muscle, as the companies did, to fight back. And he was there at the right time. Ironically, his son is the president of the Teamsters Union now.
I think that's right, isn't it?
Yep, sure is. But I always had that feeling.
That's a slice of history that you, were able to meet and talk with him and all of that. And this all is all about history. People probably wonder, why are we talking about the assassination that happened years and years and years ago? Well, it's about history. And I'm about history, and I'm about abolishing distortions of history, just like you are. We're both looking for the truth. And, you know, these are important things, important issues having to do with history. But, boy, I had no idea about that with your meeting Hoffa. He was a dangerous man, that's for sure. Bobby Kennedy, I think, was scared of him, but he was intent on putting him away. And I don't know if was Bobby Kennedy still Attorney General when they prosecuted him for tax evasion?
They got him put away, and it was Nixon who pardoned him.
He was pardoned? I don't remember.
Oh, yeah. They cut a deal. They got him out. Part of the deal to get out with Nixon was that Jimmy would not get involved in union politics anymore. He wouldn't run for the presidency of the Teamsters. I mean, that was the deal they all cut. And he signed it without even reading it, he said. He just wanted to get out. And then he realized that the deal was, you can't run for the presidency. He went ballistic. He went after all of them. But by that, the Teamsters built for the mob Las Vegas. Old-time Vegas that has now been taken over by legit corporations was built by the Teamster Pension Fund. And the mob was the one that took care of it, with Bugsy Siegel and Meyer Lansky and all those people. We're going to be back with more with Mark Shaw. We're going to open up the phone lines. We're going to talk about his new book, Collateral Damage, when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. This hour, we're going to take your phone calls with Mark Shaw, but we'll also be talking about his latest work, of course, Collateral Damage, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Mark Shaw with us. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. Mark, the new book, Collateral Damage. Now, to me, collateral damage means being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, it does. And I don't want to go any further, George, without I've gotten so many nice tips and support from your listeners. So I just want to make sure people know they can get in touch with me through my website, markshawbooks.com. But the email is mshawin@yahoo.com, and I pride myself on answering every single email that people send me. George, I was going to quit here. I'd written the Melvin Belli biography, the Poison Patriarch about Joe Kennedy, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, proving that Dorothy Kilgallen, you know, was the life and times of her, and then her death, and then The Dial of Justice, as you know, you're reading it, more about what she knew that made her so dangerous and all of that. So I was going to quit, but an awful lot of people would ask me, well, is Marilyn Monroe's death connected to Dorothy Kilgallen's? And this has been amazing, really, because the moment I started getting into looking to Marilyn's death, I ran into my co-pilot's columns about Marilyn's death, and that co-pilot is Dorothy Kilgallen, of course. She had written several columns about Marilyn before Marilyn died. I have a nice photograph of her with Marilyn at 20th Century Fox, and so they were friends. She'd written about her ups and her downs and her marriage to Joe DiMaggio and all that kind of thing. But when Marilyn died, she wrote a column that said, in essence, and it's a little longer than that, but in essence, the real truth hasn't been told. So I took that column feeling like that Dorothy kind of sent it to me. You know how I feel about that, that from the hereafter she kind of has been my guiding light.
Your inspiration.
And so I took that information and went with it. And it's been amazing, really, because I've found so many similarities, and many of them are unfortunate. For sure, there was no investigation of Marilyn's death. The L.A. police chief decided that he would appoint a 3-member psychiatrist panel to look into her mental state at the time. So there was no real investigation of any of the physical evidence or anything else. The autopsy, just like Dorothy's, was botched, the same situation in Maryland's. Thomas Noguchi, you know who that name is.
That's right. He was the coroner.
He was the coroner, and he had even admitted later that he botched the autopsy, that he forgot to inspect some of the organs that he should have of Marilyn's body, and by the time he tried to find them, this is hard to believe, but basically they were gone. So you have those kind of similarities, no investigation. What disturbed me a lot about this comparison is that they badmouth both Dorothy and Marilyn before they died. They tried to say that Dorothy had a drug problem and alcohol and all that, which was not true. There was no evidence of that. And with Marilyn, that she had tried to commit suicide several times, which was not true. She actually was, as my research has shown, and it's continuing, on the upswing. She had gotten a new contract with 20th Century Fox. She was hoping to remarry Joe DiMaggio. I'm trying to humanize all three subjects in this book. What with Marilyn, the one thing she wanted to be more than anything was a mother. She loved children. She didn't have a parent, you know, her mother and father, that was a mess. And she wanted to have a child. She wanted to be like Dorothy, who had a great, had 3 children and loved motherhood. So Marilyn was actually on the upswing. And so both Dorothy and Marilyn were badmouthed before they died, and each was in danger. As you know, Bobby Kennedy, first Jack Kennedy, and then Bobby Kennedy had romantic relationships with Marilyn.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there's one other similarity that I believe led to both women's death, and that was they were blabbermouths. Dorothy was waltzing around New York City thinking she was invincible, telling everybody she was going to crack, you know, the most important case in history and all these other kind of things.
And she probably would have.
Oh, no question that she would have. The course of history would have been changed if she could have written that book, I'm convinced. With Marilyn, she started talking too much, and I have an eyewitness who, has basically proven that Marilyn was talking about going to the media and talking about her relationships with the Kennedys.
Yep.
Not only romantic-wise,
which was unheard of in those days.
What's that?
In those days, that was unheard of. You did not do that as a politician.
No, not at all. And so there was motive to eliminate Marilyn, just like there was to eliminate Dorothy. And so, the book is called Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Death of Marilyn Monroe, Dorothy Kilgallen, and the Ties That Bind Them to the JFK Assassination. And so it's an attempt. And I'll tell you what, George, writing about one person is tough enough. If I had any idea what it was going to be like to write about 3 people, I probably wouldn't have done it, but it has really opened my eyes to the fact that when you look at all 3 of the deaths, new revelations kind of come to you, and that's what I'm going to try to do in the book. And I'm trying to show people also that the stereotypical perspectives of each person You know, we need to look at the loss that we had. JFK, for instance, yes, he ran around with a lot of women and he was assassinated and all of that. But I found, I don't know if you know about a book that Jackie Kennedy, you know, right after JFK died, she permitted Arthur Schlesinger to interview her. And I have the book. If people want to email me, I'll tell them about it. But it's her insight into their marriage and their time that they spent together as he was president. And it talks about how much he loved the children, John, and Caroline, and all of that. So you get a different perspective there. With Dorothy, I found a Good Housekeeping article she'd written about motherhood. With Marilyn, most people don't know that she was a voracious reader of, you know, books that I could never even understand, some of the James Joyce stuff and all of that, and also her writings. There's a book that I can't think of the name of it right now, but had all of her writings in it. She was a very intelligent woman. She wasn't just the dumb blonde that everybody thought she was. So that's the other thing I'm trying to do, is kind of to correct the distortions of history with those three people.
Let's go to the phones, and we'll talk a little bit more about Collateral Damage. When does it come out, by the way?
Well, we're going to get through this election and the first of the year and everything, so it'll be out after the first of the year. We're now thinking either March or April. We'll see what happens.
I was about ready to read you an email from Brandon in the state of Washington, and sure enough, he's on the phone, so I'll let him just tell you. Brandon,
good. Welcome
to the program.
Hi, George and Mark.
Hi there. Got your email. I was just ready to read it, and you're on the phone, so go ahead.
I've been listening to you, George, since high school back in 2012. And I have a question for Mark. My question is, what was the most eye-opening detail that led to your surmise that Dorothy Kilgallen may have been murdered? Thanks.
Okay, and what he was asking you was, what was that eye-opening detail that led you to investigate the Dorothy Kilgallen death or murder?
Dorothy Kilgallen was famous for the Voice of Broadway column, What's My Line and all that, but she was an amazing investigative reporter. And, you know, when I was a criminal defense lawyer and a public defender, I always look for the little things in cases. And that's what she did with Marilyn's case, you'll see. But in terms of her particular case, it was some small things that didn't make sense. First of all, I found her autopsy at the National Archives. And in the autopsy, it talked about secanol. You know, again, the verdict was an overdose of barbiturates and alcohol, circumstances undetermined. Well, that was fishy to me to begin with. Why would they put that in there? Well, I went to the autopsy. They had the secanol was listed, but when I looked at it, like everybody else could have who looked at it, it had Tylenol in there. Tylenol is another, it's kind of a step up with regard to sleeping pills. It's a little more dangerous than secanol.
Uh-huh.
And then, I wondered about that, and that made me wonder about whether she could have possibly either committed suicide or accidentally taken too many pills. But then I was able to find a witness, a toxicologist, the son of a toxicologist, who just 2 years after Dorothy died had kept her bodily fluids. I don't know what the name of that is, but anyway, you keep them for further testing. And he found phenobarbital in her system, three barbiturates. So that led me to believe that, hey, something was really wrong. But the real kicker was the fact that there was a glass that was found in the bedroom by her bed, and it was taken to the medical examiner's office, and that same toxicologist looked at it, and what did he find on the rim? He found the rim remnants of the phenobarbital. And to him, his conclusion was in his report that whoever had been involved in Dorothy's death, that he didn't think she had overdosed, whoever had been involved, either by poisoning her drink at the hotel, a bar the night she died, or at the townhouse, had emptied the capsules.
And who
and
moved
how
it?
The powder got in there, and that really led me to believe, and then through other forensics and everything, led me to believe that she did not commit suicide. It wasn't an accidental death. But she was murdered.
And who moved her body?
Well, that's still a tough one in many ways. My belief is her husband did. Richard's also, it's a true crime murder mystery again, George. Richard,
is he a suspect?
On the outs. She had an affair or two. He had some. And the book is warts and all about Dorothy.
He's dead now. The husband's dead now, right?
Yeah, he actually committed suicide just a few years after Dorothy died.
Interesting.
But they were on the outs. He knew she was going to change her will. You remember the singer. We've talked about him before, Johnny Ray.
Oh, yeah.
Little White Cloud That Cried. That was Dorothy's lover. Richard was very jealous of that, of course, and so he had motive to have eliminated Dorothy as well.
Interesting. All right, back to the phones. Let's go to Diana in the city of New York. Welcome to the show. Hi, Di. Go ahead.
Hi. I love your show, and COVID is great for me because I get to listen every night. Anyway, because I don't have to go anywhere the next day. I met Dorothy Kilgallen when I was about 5 years old. Oh, my mother, Carmen Campbell, was a columnist for UPI, United Press International. She was a member of the Overseas Press Club in New York. One night, circa 61, 62, my mother, my maternal grandmother, and I were having dinner in the dining room, and my mother introduced me to Dorothy Kilgallen, and I was thrilled because I'd seen her on What's My Line, so I thought, you know, wow, a movie star. And Dorothy was very nice to me. She looked me right in the eye. She listened to what I had to say, which wasn't much. I was 5 years old. She was very pretty. I've since read that she was unattractive. Well, not to me.
No.
Yeah, Sinatra called her the chinless one.
Beautiful lady. And very nice. And that's my comment.
Oh, that's very nice. Would you mind, I like to give firsthand accounts of people. Primary source. George knows. I don't speculate. And so if you wouldn't mind getting in touch with me through my email, it's mshawin@yahoo.com, or I think you could, you can go to my website and get in touch with me because I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about that.
And you can do it through his website too, Diana, if you didn't
please.
Get it down. Is your
that's
mom still
great.
With you?
And you're doing a great service to poor Dorothy. God bless you.
Is your mother still with you?
No, she died in 1971 of cancer.
Oh.
But oddly enough, the same year that Dorothy's husband killed himself. Dorothy's husband, by the way, married Ann Fogarty, the dress designer. We lived on the Upper East Side, too. That's why I know this.
Yeah, the dress designer.
We lived at 274th Street.
Exactly.
And Dorothy's townhouse
was in the East. Thank you so much. That's most interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Diane. Great history, isn't it?
Oh, George, it's amazing how many people are still alive. I interviewed a 99-year-old woman over here that knew Dorothy from the Stork Club, you know, and Morocco and all those nightclubs. And the other day, a guy got in touch with me. He's 90. I mean, all of these people are still around. There's a 93-year-old in Hollywood that actually was in the same dressing room as Marilyn. We should only hope to live that long, George,
exactly.
Right?
Now, the players that we suspect were involved in the JFK assassination.
Uh-huh.
Why are we hiding this? I mean, they don't seem to be individuals that we would really want to hide and protect.
No.
I mean, Marcellos, Trafficante, Jack Ruby, all these people. And Oswald probably was just the patsy, as he said he was. Why don't they want the truth to come out and simply say he was assassinated by the mobsters who didn't want the Bobby Kennedy playing in their business?
Exactly. And again, the common sense. And Dorothy sat right there at the Ruby trial and listened to all this. Jack Ruby said he'd be there when Oswald was going to be transferred, and he made like a reporter to get in the basement. I mean, she knew all that. That's why she was so dangerous. And nobody will touch her case, and it's 60 years later. And the same situation with regard to the government. None of the presidents will release all of the JFK assassination records, even though legally they're supposed to do so. What in the world, George, can they be hiding after all this time?
There's got to be something else.
I know.
There's something else to it. Bill in Los Angeles, take it away, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Hi, George.
Hey.
Hi, Mark. I'm a former journalist. I used to write for newspapers in the 80s and 90s, and I did my master's in journalism at Columbia University back in 85, and I had my project was something dealing with the Michael Stewart negligent homicide trial that, at the time, Dr. Elliot Gross, the New York City medical examiner, came up with three different causes of death, which basically caused a not guilty verdict because he could never figure out what the cause of death was, even though Michael Bodden and others said it was an obvious beating death. Based on what you've said also about Dr. Noguchi, don't you think that just general incompetence of government doctors and medical examiners is just as important a factor as a possible conspiracy, or at least as important?
Well, it's certainly questionable. Let me just think about this, and I hadn't really thought about it till I found out about what happened with Marilyn. Dorothy Kilgallen, the medical examiner, was a junior medical examiner, James Luke. Now, Bodden was a junior medical examiner. His name's on the autopsy.
But a good one.
Right. But not at that time. And he had just started out. It was his first big case, he told me.
Right.
So Helpern, I think, was the main medical examiner. He wrote a book. You know, he had an ego the size of Texas because, you know, he wrote a book about how he was the greatest medical examiner in the world. But he didn't handle Dorothy's autopsy. Same situation in Marilyn's death. Noguchi was a junior medical examiner. Kerfley, I believe, is the Kerfley or something like that, was the main medical examiner. He didn't handle Marilyn's case. And that seems to be what happens. Or, for whatever reason, as you say, they don't really the autopsy is not thorough. There's always a mistake of some sort or whatever with these big cases. These headline making cases, and we never really, in my mind, look at the Epstein situation. You know, we don't really know what happened in that case because again they just closed the door on it, and that's one of the problems we have with distortions of history. So that case in New York is a good example of the fact that we really have to ask questions. What I like about George most, and if you don't mind, I'll pat you on the back, is he asks all the questions. My books are designed to make people stop and think, and I think that's what George's show here is all about. That's why it's so popular. He makes people stop and think. They may not agree with him or me, but at least they'll stop and think about some of these important issues.
We're going to come back, Mark, and take some final phone calls in just a moment with you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. George Norrie with you. Our final segment with Mark Shaw as we talk about his work, Denial of Justice, the reporter who knew, of course, Collateral Damage, which he is still working on. Mark, the Sam Shepard case of the neurosurgeon who was convicted of killing his wife, he was since released. Mm-hmm. Dorothy Kilgallen did a great job reporting on that. That was the television show Fugitive was based on his life, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and this is a great example of the integrity that Dorothy had. In Denial of Justice, I believe you will see that I found a TV guide from way back then, and it was the same time as the Sam Shepard case. And they wrote an extended article about Dorothy being there and the fact that when she went to any trial, they all asked for her autograph, the judge, the jurors, everybody else.
Jeez.
In fact, if you go to the DorothyKilgallenStory.org, I've said this before, there's a photograph of her at the Dr. Sam Shepard case. He's in the middle of the courtroom, and all the reporters are gathered around her. At the trial, she went in, and the judge asked for her autograph. And she went in there, and this is documented, in a deposition later that helped overturn Dr. Sam Shepard's conviction.
Oh, the judge, that's right. The judge said he's guilty.
The judge, and the judge said, what are you doing here? He's guilty as hell.
Before the trial even started.
Exactly. Well, she felt like that was in confidence, and so Shepard was convicted. And on appeal then, the judge, by then he had died. And so she got in touch with F. Lee Bailey. I was privileged to try a case with F. Lee Bailey in the Midwest in the 1980s. And she got in touch with him and told him what had happened. And he used that deposition, and you'll see in Denial of Justice, I have excerpts from that deposition embedded into the book. And she basically told what happened, and Bailey later said that was the main reason that Shepard's conviction was overturned. And you may remember that after that happened, he was tried again, and then they found DNA evidence that he actually didn't murder his murderer.
And the fugitive was based on the one-armed man.
The one-armed man, that's right, exactly. Harrison Ford, that's right.
I love that story. Okay, let's go to Richard Kimball in the beginning for the TV series. Let's go next to Jim in Florida, first-time caller. Hey, Jimmy, go ahead.
Hey, Mark. Hey, George.
Hi, Jim.
George, you asked Mark a good question. Why haven't we known the truth about JFK? And what I'm about to tell you is pretty stunning. I'm 50, in my 50s and in law enforcement, and I'm very big into CSI. And back when Kennedy was shot, we didn't have CSI. We didn't have the ballistics experts, the sharpshooter experts, the forensics experts, the marksman experts like we do today.
That's right.
And the math doesn't lie. If you combine the ballistics, forensics, marksmen, and all that together and get statements from witnesses of what they heard and saw, and were led to believe Oswald shot and killed JFK to assassinate him. We don't know who hired Oswald, because he was assassinated to be silenced. Mm-hmm. But what happened was, from all the ballistics, when the first shot went out from Oswald, it hit the right side of the pavement and to the vehicle on the right side. Mm-hmm. When the shot rang out, the lead car in front of Kennedy took off. Therefore, Kennedy's car took off. Mm-hmm. The car behind Kennedy with all the Secret Services then took off. But what we don't know is that the Secret Service has assault rifles that we didn't know about and that we kind of banded and didn't want in our country. And they switched positions that morning. The driver of the vehicle was actually the marksman in the third vehicle. He reached down under the seat, grabbed the assault rifle to turn around to where the shot rang out. When the cars took off, one car takes off, two car takes off, the third car takes off. It jerks the car into a forward motion to where, when he went to spin around, his shot accidentally went off with his finger on the trigger, and the Secret Service is who shot the final blow, the only blow, into Kennedy. And it's been covered up by the Secret Service and the government and the presidents over the years, because who wants to know that our own people assassinated our president?
Well, you say accidental, though.
It was an accidental shooting by the Secret Service.
Have you heard that before, Mark?
Well, it's interesting. I never had until recently. Somebody brought that to my attention as well, that could have happened. I have to tell you, I think George knows this, I haven't really gotten into that part of the JFK assassination in terms of the ballistics and where the shots came from and all of that. There's so much, evidence both ways in terms of what happened or whatever. All I know is that from the Ruby trial transcripts, Oswald certainly did not act alone. But that could have happened. I mean, there's so much could have happened. A gentleman sent me the other day, there were the manhole covers. On Elm Street there. And he sent me photographs that he actually took by getting down in the manhole.
Jeez.
And looking upward toward the pavement to show how somebody could have actually been in that manhole and shot the president. So all of these things are really possible. What really drives me crazy, though, and I'm sure it does George too, is the government not releasing the documents that we need to see, the hiding of that.
Yeah.
It's like the,
what are they hiding?
That's right. It's like the Sixth Floor Museum at Daley Plaza. I wrote the Commissioner of Education in Texas last week, the letter's on my website, markshawbooks.com, telling them that they need to close that damn place because kids go through there. They only give the Oswald alone theory. It's such a distortion of history, and that really bothers me. The same thing with, the cover-ups of Dorothy's death or Marilyn's or whatever. But more than anything, there just is no reason why our government should be hiding these JFK assassination documents. And you know what? Your theory that you just came up with could be a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know if it's part of that. And unfortunately, that's hidden from us.
Yep, absolutely. The staff of What's My Line, they were in shock when she died.
Oh, they certainly were. But again, I have to tell you, George, one of the problems I have is in similarities with Marilyn's death again. Nobody stood up for Dorothy, not her children, not the What's My Line people, not her journalist friends, not her other friends. Nobody came forward and said Dorothy Kilgallen would have never accidentally overdosed on barbiturates and alcohol. Same thing with Marilyn. Nobody came forward and said, her life was on the upswing. She would have not committed suicide. By the way, I forgot to say that, do you know what the actual verdict was on Marilyn's death? It was probable suicide.
Yeah. Yep.
And Dr. Wecht, who I'm sure you've had on the program.
Great pathologist.
Who's my go-to guy with regard to any of that, such an expert. He made the statement. He had what was it? He'd conducted 150,000, he thought, autopsies. He'd never seen a verdict that said probable suicide. So, you know, these things, it's ridiculous that they're being hidden from us, but nobody seems to be doing anything about it.
He looked at the JonBenet Ramsey case. He looked at the JFK case. He's an amazing pathologist.
He certainly is. I have great, great respect for him.
Are you concerned about your own safety?
Well, people ask me that at times, George, but my answer is the same one I've given before. You go on the air every day, and you offend people, many people, I'm sure, with what you say or what you present. But my bet is you don't worry about that. When you're a person of the truth and you're trying to let people know all sides of the story and have them stop and think about things, you're going to risk that. I've had my email hacked. I've had my Facebook page hacked. Just recently, I had another hack job. I've gotten one really strange letter a couple months ago, but I can't worry about that. You know, this is my contribution to history. These are matters that are important. They're of historical importance, and I'm going to continue. Now I'm sure that I'm offending the commissioner of the New York Police Department. Well, if he wants to cause me problems, have me harm for doing that, fine. That's just the way it is, because I'm not going to let him get away with covering up Dorothy Kilgallen's death.
Let's go to Harry in Brooklyn, New York. Harry, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George. How are you? Good to speak with you.
You
again.
Too, Harry.
We've spoken about astral body projection.
Yep.
If you remember? Okay.
I do.
Three stories. One, this gentleman was interviewed on TV. He was Carlos Marcellos.
That's right.
His lawyer.
Okay.
I think I don't recall his name. I think it was Cohn. He was a mob lawyer.
Roy Cohn.
That's it. You got it. And he walked into Marcellus's bedroom. Marcellus was sitting there on his bed, and he had just gotten off the phone. He heard Marcellus said, "Do it."
Mm-hmm.
And Marcellus says to him, "You know what I just did?" He said, "No." He said, "I just ordered the assassination of the President of the United States."
Mm-hmm.
So I believe it was 6 months to a year later, Kennedy was dead.
Mm-hmm.
Story number two, Marilyn Monroe was visited by Robert Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
He took a private helicopter there. The records proved it, but he denied it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the week that she died.
Mm-hmm.
Story number three, the waitress who worked for Jack Ruby in Ruby's, his nightclub,
mm-hmm.
she spoke. It was a lot of years later, and they asked her why she was talking so later from the situation, and she said because she was scared she was going to get killed.
Mm-hmm.
She was a waitress. He called her over to a table that he was talking with somebody, and he said to her, "I want you to meet my friend Lee."
Mm.
She never met him, didn't know him, says, "Oh, hi, hello," went back to work. Mm. They were in. It was like in before they opened up the nightclub. She said, she was interviewed on TV. She said that she had seen Lee Harvey Oswald on TV when he was arrested
mm-hmm.
for the assassination of Kennedy. And it was the same guy that Jack Ruby was talking to at the table
mm-hmm.
who introduced her to him as Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So Ruby knew Lee Harvey Oswald.
That makes it even more stranger, doesn't it, Mark?
Well, it does, and it really points, you know, people wonder why. Dorothy Kilgallen wrote all those columns, George, and you've seen them in Denial of Justice there in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much. You know, a few days after JFK was killed, the Oswald file must not close. Talked about Jack Ruby at the trial. You know, there's something fishy about all this and everything, and people wonder why nobody paid attention back then. And you have to remember that you had J. Edgar Hoover out there shouting to the world, "Oswald alone, Oswald alone," because if it was this this crazy guy, this Oswald guy, this nut, then the FBI could have not stopped it. They could have never stopped the assassination. But if it's any sort of plot to kill the president, I don't like the word conspiracy, plot to kill the president, then the FBI could have been held accountable.
And they tried before in Florida, and was it not Chicago?
Well, supposedly they did, for sure. I don't think there's any question that, you know, you have to remember the relationship between J. Edgar Hoover and the Kennedys was not a good one, especially with Bobby. Bobby wanted to replace him. In fact, in that book that I mentioned to you, that Jackie Kennedy recalls, you know, her days in the White House with JFK and everything. She says in there that if JFK would have been elected, they would have fired J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah, they hated him.
They hated him. And so, you know, the whole thing with Hoover overshadowed anything that anybody was trying to say other than the Oswald alone theory.
But Hoover had too much on Kennedy's. He had he had all kinds of stuff.
They certainly did. But the points that this gentleman made about Roy Cohen and Marcello, that's reasonable. You will see, once I'm getting done with my research, you're right about the fact that Bobby Kennedy, he said he was in San Francisco the day that Marilyn died. That isn't true. And as far as the carousel goes, I thought you were going to take it one step further. That waitress that you're talking about not only said that Oswald was there, but that Carlos Marcello basically was the one who operated the carousel bar, not really Jack Ruby.
It was his bar, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Just
all those connections.
Will we ever get the real answers, Mark? I mean, you're doing a great job, but you're out there all by yourself.
Well, some people think I'm crazy, especially when I think when I say that Dorothy's guided me from the hereafter, and I think Marilyn may be helping me some too these days. But you know, I'll just keep throwing out what I can in terms of facts and primary sources. You know, it's interesting to me that people are going to believe what they want to, and there is a whole crowd out there, a whole cult. You know, I think you know about the Allen Library presentation I gave in Texas last November. For whatever reason, the presentation on YouTube went viral, and one day it was 10,000 views, and then it was 650,000
overnight.
And I looked at what the responses were, and for the most part, they were positive. But there is a group of people out there, and I respect them dearly, who will always believe it was Oswald alone, or they have their own.
And they're entitled to that.
Then they're entitled to that, and they don't need to agree with me. But it's amazing to me in some ways that, you know, I think in many people's minds at least, you know, Dorothy Kilgallen is our eyewitness to history with regard to the JFK assassination, and she deserves that label.
Well, you keep doing what you're doing, Mark Shaw. And Mark's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com.